From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, and our first guest this morning is writer and wilderness guide Michael Engelhard. Engelhard has spent decades exploring the wilderness through the American West and Alaska, and he's written numerous books on his experiences exploring and guiding others through these locations. That's in the first part of the show.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll stay in Alaska, but this time go offshore and learn about Alaska's whales. We'll speak with Andy Szabo, director of the Alaska Whale Foundation. He'll describe what research the foundation is performing and break down, among other things, a recent study that expands the understanding of how humpback whales work together to net fish using bubbles. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And our first guest today is Michael Engelhard. Michael is an anthropologist, wilderness guide, and author. First, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll start talking about how you embarked on this adventure.
Yes, I came to Alaska in 1989 from Germany, originally just meant to be here for a year as an international exchange student in the anthropology program at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And here I am 35 years later, still here. I got a degree and I ended up dropping out of the academic environment for various reasons and became a wilderness guide and outdoors educator.
And so you're starting your career in taking people out into the wilderness, teaching them how to love nature and teaching them how to survive in nature. And what was the impetus to embarking on this Arctic traverse then? Because not only is it a big tip to do with a group, but you accomplished this solo.
Yes. I could not find anybody that wanted to come along with me either for the time reasons. It was a 58-day trip, so major commitment in time and money. But the reason I went is that I guide a lot of two-week trips up there in the Brooks Range, and I felt that despite that time, I never have enough opportunities to explore all the nooks and crannies, because my first responsibility was always to look after people. But the maps, when I was planning these trips, they had so many promising areas that I wanted to explore, so I decided to spend the whole summer and traverse the range, also to get an understanding how large it is. It is the largest official wilderness area in the world, about 1,000 miles between the Canadian border and the Bering Strait.
Wow. And so when you embark on this journey, you know some of the harrowing, I guess, adventures or encounters that you might have, one being bears?
Yeah, I have bear sightings or encounters. Sighting is when you see a bear and it doesn't see you, and encounter is when the bear sees you and usually interacts with you in some form or other. And I had one on average every other day on this trip. So I encountered about 70 bears or so.
So when you're on a trip like this, how does a typical day unfold? Do you have a plan to get from point A to point B? Or you say you explored nooks and crannies. How did that unfold on a daily basis?
There are only two fixed dates. The dates usually when you get dropped off by your charter airplane and the date that you need to be at the pickup spot.
Okay.
Everything in between is totally flexible, and you need to travel like that in this environment because it's very dynamic. Things change at a moment's notice, and people usually get into trouble when they're not flexible, when they're trying to stick to itineraries. Plus, the other thing is that you cannot really plan camps, because even on the map, an area that might look suitable for camping might turn out not to be when you get there. It could be swampy, or the banks could be too rocky to pitch tents and so on.
Oh, so maybe there is some opportunity here to edit some of those maps.
Well, I have a mind. They look totally scribbled in because I did not even bring a notebook, which is actually shameful to admit by a writer. But since I was carrying the maps outside in my backpack, they were easy to reach, and I just pulled them out so often and kept my notes in that, the journals, and that I then described for the book.
So you did take journals and notes because you have pretty detailed accounts of some of the areas, the landscape in which that you are going, these experiences encountering bears. And also, you incorporate a lot of indigenous culture and knowledge in this book as well.
Yes, that's because of my background as an anthropologist, and I've long struggled with the idea of wilderness, what it actually means. And to a lot of people, it means that the absence of humans. But if you apply that yardstick, then we haven't had any true wilderness in North America for 20,000 years or so since people first arrived from Northeast Asia. So what to us is wilderness is homeland to other people, to the native people, and has been for generations.
Did you come upon other people during this this traverse?
Very few. Week one, I had one of the resupplies that I was picking up had been left with a hunter that had a hunting camp out there, a grizzly hunter. And the other time I saw people was at the Hall Road, what we call the Hall Road, is the Dalton Highway from Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay that follows the pipeline. So there was a Department of Transportation depot that I actually had to use the phone because my resupply was supposed to be there and wasn't there at an airstrip. And then the third encounter with people was in Anaktuvuk Pass, which is an Inupiaq native Eskimo village in the heart of Gates of the Arctic National Park. And I had one supply cache mailed to me there to the post office, which I picked up.
Okay. So you had supplies, but were you also foraging for food at during that time too?
Only berries. I had six caches along the route that I had prearranged and needed to pick up, usually food for about 9 days. And the last one was at the headwaters of the Noatak River for the river trip part of the journey, and that was 2 weeks' worth of food. Foraging, the only foraging I did was picking blueberries when they became ripe, because it's just too time-consuming. Friends actually asked me when I set off, are you going to live off the land? And I said, if you trying to do this traverse in one summer, you cannot afford to do that. It's just too much work and slows you down.
Huh.
I did not even bring fishing gear because fishing is relatively easy, but the smell of fish around camp when you're by yourself, I wanted to avoid that because it's a bear attractant.
Yeah, getting back to that,
right.
You had said that you had about 70 sightings or bear encounters. What were some of the
70 bears total, not 70 encounters. There were sometimes two or three bears at a time.
I see. So 70 bears total, but still, I think that is far more than any of us will encounter. Were there along the way some lessons that you learned that you took with you for the next encounter, or did you already feel like you had this understanding of how to react to them?
I had a pretty good understanding of bear behavior because I usually encounter some on almost every trip I've guided up there. The problem with that is that bears are really individuals and they make individual decisions, and there's just no hard and fast recipe of how to deal with them. There's no other wild animal that you see individual personalities as clearly, or as I have seen as clearly, as in grizzly bears.
And describe that a little bit when you say personalities. What are you referring to?
Well, usually the younger males, like in humans, they're a little more pushy. They test you. Whereas females with cubs, they're just protective of cubs. And their first priority is to get out there without the cubs being injured. Because older male grizzlies, for example, they kill cubs when they encounter them. And so females are very protective and very, they might charge you. I did get charged once by a female grizzly that I surprised, but she just wanted to make sure that I'm not harming her cubs.
So 58 days, I'm assuming that you made it to your destination on the 58th or so day?
It's kind of embarrassing to admit, but I had to be rescued on my last day.
Oh
no.
When I got to the coast, look pretty good for the crossing because the end point is a Kotzebue, a town that's on an island.
Yeah.
And it's a 13-mile crossing on the Sound. And it didn't look too bad that day, but I hadn't accounted for the fact that once you get out of the wind shadow of the mainland, that the wind picks up. And so I was out there and getting really blown out to sea. I was looking at my GPS and I could see that I was getting farther away from Kotzebue rather than closer to it.
Oh.
And it was so rough that I could not even take my hands from the oars because the boat would have gone sideways and probably capsized. So I could not even call. I had a satellite phone. I could not even call for help. And eventually I ended up flagging down a ship, a boat that was going out for setting fishnets that native people were on. And they helped me aboard. And in 15 minutes straight, I was in Kotzebue.
Oh, wow. What an ending. I'm sure that boat that saved you was quite curious as to why you would be out there.
No, they're used to white people doing silly things. They didn't even ask many questions.
Yeah, exactly. We're speaking with Michael Engelhardt. He is a wilderness guide and author of numerous books, including Arctic Traverse, 1,000-Mile Summer of Trekking the Brooks Range. And so we've been focused on that, but Michael, you've also spent a number of time, years or so, hiking down here in the American West, and I'm guessing probably in some parts of Utah and Arizona, correct?
That is my other spiritual home. I used to live in Flagstaff in Moab, and I'm actually about to move back there to Moab. I have been guiding in the Grand Canyon river trips and work for Outward Bound down there. So yes, I'm very familiar with Southern Utah and Northern Arizona. And also have a new book out about the Grand Canyon called No Walk in the Park.
Right.
I did a 40-day attempted traverse of the Grand Canyon on the north side, which I had to abort.
Wow, when did you try that?
The year after my Arctic traverse, I got a hankering for long distance trips.
And being alone.
On this one, on the Grand Canyon, I had a hiking partner, and that was part of the problem.
Ah, yes, people. Always getting in the way. So
it brings out the best and the worst in us.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. But what was the intended length of this trip? You know, where did you start and what was the intended finish?
We started at Lee's Ferry.
Yeah.
Where the Grand Canyon river trips also start. And we were going to end at Lake Mead.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I have to speculate that you probably have a great reverence for these landscapes. You just said this is my spiritual home. Why do you feel like we need this reverence for the earth? And why is it important for people to understand these landscapes and what's happening there and why we should care about it?
It's our home, really. It's our evolutionary home. That's where we evolved, and it actually shaped us over the millennia. And we're losing this connection with the land and the outdoors only at the risk of societal dysfunction. So I think a lot of the symptoms that we're seeing now can be attributed to that.
Right. But at the same time, are you seeing more and more people going out into the wilderness, more interest in the wilderness? And maybe more people who are going out in the wilderness that maybe aren't ready to go out in the wilderness.
It is definitely getting busy. I'm seeing more people in places where there didn't used to be any. And I think part of that has to do with the social media that are popularizing these places more. Instagram people just go out for a view. And I've seen a lot of people that are A, ill-prepared,
right,
and B, go for reasons that are more social, actually. I see large groups that pay attention to each other more than to their surroundings and are not very well educated about the history, the natural history, and the cultural history of the places they're going to. And that was always a big goal for me as a guide, not just to keep people safe and entertained, but also to teach them about these places more than they would see on a two-week vacation, so that they hopefully start to care about them and speak up when they're being threatened by development and other developments. Like industrial tourism, for example, is a big problem now too, where people just are as hard on the land as cattle or mining almost.
Huh. Interesting. Loving, you know, in some ways, loving the land to death, or
yes,
not understanding, you know, try to leave no trace. And like you say, there are more and more people going out there perhaps to just take photos and selfies rather than truly understand or engage themselves, immerse themselves in the wilderness.
And it's this bucket list thing too. There are people that are trying to see all parks, 59 or whatever, in a certain amount of time, in a year, let's say. And I always say, why don't you spend 1 year in one park? You actually might really learn something about the place.
Yeah, and you had mentioned that, how when you're guiding, you don't really get to maybe sit by that waterway or that river and really take it in, or watch the sun go down and really take in how the light is hitting this area or that area, or how the flora and fauna are reacting to that. So what were some of the things, I'm curious, in either of these expeditions that maybe were even unexpected to you or that you discovered?
On the Arctic Traverse, I really discovered that after 2 weeks, something substantially changes about your perception of the place. Hmm. And you start to develop instincts that you weren't even aware that existed in you. And it's hard to explain, and it sounds a little new agey, but for example, this one time I was following a creek really narrow, and for some reason I thought I needed to cross to the other side. There were no obvious reason for that, because the going wasn't any better on the other side, and I had to get my feet wet, but I did follow that inner voice. And sure enough, when I came around the corner, there was a female bear sitting on the trail. Well, not the trail, there was no trail, but sitting right where I would have walked by, and she had two cubs, and they were feeding on some dead sheep, so I would have gotten really into trouble.
Oh.
That's just one example.
Right. And going back to that, again, this was a trip, like you said, that it didn't involve trails. This was just bushwhacking your way from point A to point B, of so to speak, in a general direction each day.
Well, it wasn't all bushwhacking. There were stretches of bushwhacking, but there's a lot of open country up there. It's tundra in the Arctic. Creek crossings, a lot of river crossings. And the only paths you follow are caribou paths. They leave those scored into the tundra on the annual migration. But they're too narrow for a person really to comfortably walk in often.
Wow. In addition to walking and hiking, you've done river guiding as well?
Yes. Sea kayaking, climbing, mountain biking. I've done ski trips.
Okay. And when, go back again, when did this first start? What year did you first start to go out into the wilderness?
Even before I came to the United States, I always went to Canada and to the Rockies and to Norway. I always had a fascination for northern landscapes. Mm. Too much Jack London, probably, as a teenager.
Have you done this in the winter, then? You've done this all four seasons?
Not guided, but I do private trips. I did a trip up here in the Arctic, a skiing trip with friends last April. So to us, that qualifies as winter. There's still snow in the ground,
right,
and it gets beastly cold up there.
What is a trip that you haven't taken that you want to do?
I may think about finishing that Grand Canyon through hike that I did not get to finish.
And how far in were you when that went awry?
40 days.
40 days?
So I'll have two more weeks, one stretch between Toruip and Lake Mead.
So you were so close, so you could pick it up from there and take it through.
I go back to the place that I hiked in already, but I wouldn't necessarily do the whole stretch again.
So again, what would you, as people are reading your writings, what is it that you want them to take away? What is it that you want people to engage in or know more about in these areas that you have gone?
I would say find your own wild place, and it can be your backyard, and it can be little things too. That's one thing I learned on my traverse, is to pay attention to the small stuff. Because it's not always bears and raging rivers. Sometimes just a little flower at your feet. that makes you curious about what it is and how it fits into the whole big picture. And you can't find that anywhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you're right. We don't need to spend thousands of dollars and a week of our time to go trekking somewhere. We can find, like you say, Michael, wilderness right here in our own backyards. And maybe even in many ways, that's a better way of discovering nature and the wild, that it's right there in front of us.
Absolutely.
I'm not saying it's the better way necessarily, but it starts at home and then it expands from there, the care.
The curiosity and care.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, we appreciate you joining us. And where can people go to learn more about you and your writings?
My website, michaelenglehart.com.
Perfect. Well, we appreciate you being on the show, and we hope that you have another great adventure ahead of you.
Oh, yeah. We're looking forward to touching base with you again in the future.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael Engelhard, who has written a memoir of wilderness, culture, connections, and gritty adventure across northern Alaska and Arctic traverse, and also one about the Grand Canyon. You can go to michaelengelhard.com to learn more about him and his adventures and writings.
And joining us for the second part of the show is Andy Szabo. He's the director of the Alaska Whale Foundation, and he's here to talk about all things whales and the foundation and some of the, and the research they're involved in. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with Claire and me on This Green Earth.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you too.
Let's start here. Give us a little background on the Alaska Whale Foundation, its mission, goals, objectives, etc.
Of course, yeah. We were founded in 1996, largely to support whale and ocean health research initiatives. About 10 years ago, we created a field station here in Southeast Alaska. Now we operate a team of between 8 and 10 people every year out of this field station, where we're conducting, as I said, a lot of whale and ocean health research initiatives.
So, describe some of that research that's going on. Is it primarily focused on Alaska-based whales?
It is. Most of our work has been on humpback whales, which are sort of the main large whales that we find in our area here. And starting in about 2016, we launched what we're calling a whale health campaign. Mm. And essentially what our work is we go out there and every month of every year, and we're mapping out the distribution and the abundance of whales in our study area, which is quite a large area. We are taking all sorts of health metrics. We're using drones to look at body condition. We're collecting biopsy samples to look at reproduction and stress hormone levels. We're taking photo ID so we could recognize individual whales across days, weeks, and years. Essentially, we're going out there, we're giving individual whales a health exam, and we do this, like I said, week to week, month to month, year to year, to track how the population is doing. And while that's going on, we're also collecting a whole lot of oceanographic data so we can monitor how the oceans are doing and how that's impacting the whales.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a little bit. But how many different types of whales are you tracking?
For the most part, we're encountering humpbacks up here. We do get killer whales in our study area, and when we see them, we're certainly collecting data on them as well. Most of those data we'll share with colleagues who are focused specifically on them. We've recently begun a new project looking at gray whales that migrate through our area here in basically March through May. But again, most of the time we're focused on humpback whales.
Which is a very fascinating species, and there's a new study that's come out about how they feed. But first, can we lay some groundwork and foundation about these humpback whales and just how fascinating they are, maybe starting with their socialization and how they hunt and feed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. I think they're one of the most exciting whales for sure to study. One of the things that's really unique about humpback whales is, for one, they have a very diverse behavioral repertoire. They have a whole wide array of foraging tactics that they use, from things like bubble net foraging that we'll talk about, mm-hmm. to any number of different tactics. But they also have this very unique social structure. Most baleen whales are not particularly social, but the humpbacks we have up here in Southeast Alaska form these teams of 12, 14, 16 members. and they'll work together to deploy bubble nets and to use feeding calls to manipulate their prey, and they'll divvy up the roles within these groups. And so they have this very coordinated, choreographed feeding tactic that's really exciting to watch. But again, they also have this very diverse behavior or acoustic repertoire. They're very communicative. So they're just a really exciting animal. Add to that that they're coastal, so we can see them readily. It's just a great species to study.
Yeah, and when you say they're very acoustic, I think that's one of the things that people maybe do know about humpback whales, is that they have this, they call it a song or singing. And these songs, I guess, can last up to 15 minutes, but it's mostly the males that do this. Why is this something that they deploy out there into the ocean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are certainly well known for their song. And that is something that only the males, as you said, produce. And by and large, they only produce that on their warm subtropical breeding grounds. And it's associated with mating. So it's usually the males, presumably, are trying to establish territories and or attract females by using that song. And as you said, these songs can last for 15, 20 minutes. And the interesting thing about the song is all the animals within a breeding population, for the most part, are singing the same song at the same time, but that song evolves over time. But here in Alaska, where I work, we don't really hear much song, maybe early in the season when the whales are just coming back from the breeding ground or just before they leave in the fall. But for the most part, there's really no mating activity going on here. So we're not hearing singers, but we are hearing a lot of chatter. As I said, they have this very diverse acoustic repertoire. They're making all sorts of different calls and sounds that almost certainly are being used for communication when they're doing things like coordinating their behaviors in some of these very complex foraging tactics.
So in addition to their chatter, say, there's lots of other noises that are going on in the waters, quite a bit of it perhaps man-made. Is noise pollution, so to speak, in the ocean environment a growing problem?
It certainly seems to be a growing problem. There are a lot more ships in the water now than there used to be, and that seems to be increasing. And there's all sorts of other sources of noise from mining exploration and naval activities. And this is certainly putting a lot of sound into the water. Now, we are somewhat fortunate, comparatively so, up here in Southeast Alaska, and there's just not nearly the boat traffic and a lot of these other activities that put sound into the water are not going on. So I would not say that that's really the biggest threat to the whales that we are seeing. Certainly for very acoustically sensitive animals like toothed whales that echolocate, they have very sensitive hearing. Those are the ones that are most likely to be impacted by human anthropogenic noise in the oceans.
Are humpbacks kind of a keystone species in a sense that give you an idea like a healthy or the presence of a humpback group is the sign of a healthy environment?
Yeah, we would refer to that as an indicator species.
Indicator?
And certainly, yeah, the health of whales really reflects the health of the ecosystem. And also healthy whale populations are actually important for creating healthy ecosystems. But that is, again, one of the reasons why humpbacks are such a useful species for us to study up here, because if we start detecting changes in their population, any sort of health changes in terms of stress levels or body condition, things like that, things that we can pick up quite quickly, that really points to something that's going on with the underlying ecosystem. That's certainly something we've been seeing over the last 10 years, fluctuations in these populations that are indicating something's going on with the ocean.
Is that something, I'll go there, is it warming water? Is it changing currents? Is it food supply impacts from, say, human activity? I'm sure the answer is yes to all three, but Andy, go ahead and elaborate.
Yes, unfortunately it is, yes. And there's no question that warming oceans are impacting these populations. Alaska Whale Foundation, together with a number of our colleagues up here in Alaska and throughout the North Pacific, detected some really striking changes in whale populations that began to happen around 2016, which followed this very significant warm water event called the Blob, or the Pacific Marine Heat Wave. Mm-hmm. And essentially the Gulf of Alaska and the North Pacific more generally was 3 or 4 degrees warmer than average for about 2 years, which was quite unprecedented in terms of the duration and the scale of that event. And that had very clear detrimental impacts on not just whales, but the entire marine ecosystem. But certainly we're now working on a study with our colleagues up at the Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve that are suggesting that there was probably a mass mortality event that happened with these humpback whales. Maybe 25% of the population in Alaska was lost due to that warm water event or following that. And we're seeing this sort of these types of effects impacting all sorts of trophic levels throughout these North Pacific marine ecosystems.
And just to follow on, you know, 3 to 4 degrees, Andy, to me and you and Claire, doesn't sound like a tremendous increase in temperature. Oh, 3 to 4 degrees, you know, come on. You can, yeah. But to marine species, that is a life-threatening condition. You say they literally perhaps died from heat exhaustion or so?
No, that's not what seems to be happening. What happens when you have warm water is it stabilizes, because it's almost, warm water is almost like oil on water. It floats to the top and it stabilizes the water column. And what that does ultimately is interfere with the circulation of nutrients up into the surface waters where all the phytoplankton grow. Those are the plants of the sea. And once you have that occurring, you get declines in phytoplankton, and then you have this domino effect or this cascading effect throughout the trophic web. So you have declining zooplankton, and then you have declining fish, and that makes its way all the way through to, in our case, the humpback whales.
So speaking of how they're feeding and how this works, let's get to this new study that you just did where you are finding that these humpback whales are creating what has been termed bubble nets. Describe what that is and what their food intake generally is and how this helps them to bring it in.
Yeah, of course. So bubble netting, which, by the way, has been something that has been described, I think, 1920s was the first description by perhaps some whalers up here in Alaska. So this is something that people have been seeing for a while. But what the animals are doing is they will swim down to depth. In our study, we found they're swimming down to about 20 meters, and they'll start blowing air out of their blowholes as they're swimming along at about a meter and a half a second. That seems to be the speed they're swimming. And as they're doing that, they're swimming in a circular direction. And so those bubbles are forming a curtain or a spiral that start rising up to the surface. And that ultimately creates a cylinder that the animals are able to use to corral. In the case of these solitary whales that we studied, concentrate their prey. So if you think about the krill that the animals are feeding on, those krill may be in relatively low density, so low that it may not be profitable for a whale to take a big old mouthful of that. They're just not going to get enough krill as they need. Mm. Keep in mind that krill are tiny shrimp-like crustaceans that are less than an inch long, so a whale needs a lot of those. So if they're not occurring in the densities they need to make it profitable, what appears to happen is they'll start to create these really complex, elaborate bubble nets. And what we found from our study was the bubble nets, the actual structure of the nets, are these sort of nested rings that get smaller and smaller and smaller. And so what we think is happening is the whales are corralling this large area of krill, and then they're condensing them further and further and further into these real small patches that are basically not much larger than the size of the mouth of the whale. Hmm. And so now you have this real high density aggregation of krill that are contained and can't go anywhere because they seem very averse to swimming across those bubble curtains. And the whales are able to just sort of do a slow lunge right through the middle. And what we're estimating is these animals can get maybe 7 times on average as much prey in a bubble net than they would if they weren't using that bubble net. And that essentially means 7 fewer mouthfuls of prey to get the same amount.
Yeah, who's not going to be opposed to that? How many whales does it take, or typically, to create this net?
Well, that was one of the things that was quite notable. We have been studying cooperative bubble net foraging up here in Alaska for 25 years. My colleague Fred Sharp was one of the first people to look at this. And that is a behavior where you'll have 12, 14 whales working together using a bubble net. But in our case, these are solitary whales. These are individual whales who are working by themselves and who are able to deploy this big, large bubble net and target the krill that way. So it's quite interesting to see this comparison. The other thing is we're starting to realize there's quite a difference between the bubble nets used in these sort of cooperative events or cooperative behaviors relative to what we're seeing in these solitary whales. So it seems like these whales are actually able to adjust that tool based upon the social setting or environmental features or the types of prey that they're feeding on. which really suggests a very complex cognition for these animals to be able to think through this and develop different types of tools.
Yeah. How much food do they need to survive in a day or a week?
That's a really good question. And the simple answer seems to always be 500 pounds, which is very convenient. It is quite challenging to address that because we don't really know how much they're able to take in with each mouthful. As you can imagine, you can't be in front of a whale as it's about to lunge. But we can do energetic modeling. And we can look, for example, at how much mass a whale gains over the course of its summer foraging season. And we can use that to estimate the amount of prey. And I've heard some people suggest that maybe as few as 1,000 herring is what a whale would need if they were feeding on herring in a given day. So that roughly translates to somewhere around 500 to 1,000 pounds of food. But even that really depends on the species of prey, which all differ calorically, and the size of those prey, and even the life stage of those prey. For example, a herring that's about to spawn, that's full of eggs, is going to have a lot of calories. Mm. If you feed on that same fish a week later after it's spawned, all those eggs are gone, half the calories. It's like comparing celery and bacon, for example.
And you know, sorry, no, I was just going to say, do you see behavior changes between how males and females do this?
Not that we can see. These behaviors seem to be readily adopted by both males and females. And one of the cool things we see with these cooperative bubble netters up here, males and females work together quite closely and will actually form these sort of enduring bonds that can persist for multiple decades. That's very unusual for mammals. But again, we got to keep in mind that there's such a clear spatial and temporal separation between breeding behavior, which happens in the warm water where males are competing for females, and feeding behavior, which happens up here in Alaska, where actually it pays to work together, both males and females. So again, we don't really see much in the way of differences up here in terms of the two male and female sexes.
We're speaking with Andy Szabo. He's the director of the Alaska Whale Foundation. We're talking about their research and their work up there in Southeast Alaska, and particularly with respect to humpback whales. I'm always fascinated at the evolutionary process that is involved in species developing skills. In effect, skills using tools, you know, in this case, bubbles, to capture prey. I mean, I'm sure that's a tough one to answer, Andy, but any senses of like who was the first whale that said, hey, you know what, I'm going to try this bubble thing, or maybe I did it by mistake and it's like, hey, this really works. I know I'm not being somewhat flip, but there is an evolutionary process to that and passing that behavior on to their young.
Yeah, you touch on a couple things there. For one, we know that humpback whales are the only species that do this.
Oh,
and
okay.
We think that has to do with, in terms of baleen whales, we think that has to do with morphological features. They have very large pectoral flippers that make them much more maneuverable than, say, a blue whale or a fin whale, very broad flukes. So again, they can actually create these very tight spirals that, say, a blue whale could not. But within the species, we certainly don't know who was the first whale to do this.
Right.
And almost certainly it's been going on for a long time before we've been observing them. As I said, it was in the 1920s that the whalers first reported this in Alaska. We also know that multiple populations of whales that do not interact, for example, whales down in Antarctica, our colleagues just published a paper of bubble net foraging that they were seeing going on down there. Those populations independently evolved or appeared to independently evolve this behavior. So we know that they can do this. They can figure these things out. And again, there's a whole diverse behavioral repertoire that these animals have, suggesting that they are quite adept at coming up with new strategies. With respect to how it's maintained in the population, individual learning almost certainly is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. But with respect to some of these cooperative ones, almost certainly they're watching each other, and they'll be in these groups feeding, and there'll be a bubble blower in there, and one of the whales who's maybe never done it before, and of course I'm speculating a little bit here because we can never be with the whales when this is happening, but I imagine that if that group breaks up for some reason in the day, you're going to have two different groups now, and one of them is not going to have a bubble blower in it. And so presumably one of those whales who was not a bubble blower before thinks, you know what, I'm going to give this a try and see if it works. And if it does and they become successful, and presumably they'll keep doing it. That's how it sort of spreads over time.
How was your observations performed? Are you actually, obviously, maybe in the water with them, or is there some underwater craft you use? And you mentioned drone technology, too, providing valuable insight into their behaviors.
Yeah, we certainly don't get into the water with them. It's often too opaque here anyway. We wouldn't be able to see too much, and the whales are moving too quickly for us to keep up with them. But the two key developments in the last 10 years with respect to understanding underwater and just behavior in general for these animals are, as you said, drones, which give us this aerial perspective so we can see from above what these bubble nets look like when they arrive at the surface, but also the use of these suction cup CATS tags that we've been using. Mm. These are football-shaped tags that have four suction cups on them. They literally just stick onto the animal. You use a 20-foot pole to pop it on its back. The whale essentially doesn't notice it's there. It pops off benignly after about 4 to 12 hours. But what those tags carry are cameras, hydrophones, temperature sensors, depth sensors, and also these accelerometers that can determine what the three-dimensional position of the animal is underwater. And that allows us to recreate exactly what the animal is doing underwater, what it can see underwater, what it can hear underwater. And it was the combination of those two tools, the tags and the drones, that allowed us to do this or publish this paper, do the research that led to this paper.
Now, you said there was a certain time period that they fall off. Do you ever follow, because they have this crazy long migration, is there ever this tool in which you follow them through this migration?
Mm-hmm. There certainly are tags. There are subdermal tags that individuals will use that will stay on a whale for a month and a half at times. And those can be useful for looking at migration. But by and large, for us, we're actually just matching images of the flukes of the whales. And I mentioned this earlier. If you take a picture of the underside of a tail of a whale, you can recognize an individual whale from that fluke print. It's much like a fingerprint. Mm. So you can create catalogs of flukes of whales that we see, for example, here in Alaska, and then we can compare those to catalogs from our colleagues in places like Hawaii. And it's because of that that we know that 85% of the whales here in Alaska migrate to Hawaii in the winter months, about 15% go to Mexico, all just through that photographic technique.
I see, because each one of their tails is unique to the specific animal itself. That's fascinating.
So circling back to their threats and their overall health, we touched upon climate change and how warming waters are impacting their health and welfare. Do they have conflicts with the local fishing industry or cruise ships? We talked about noise pollution too. Touch on that.
Yeah, those are two significant sources of mortality, unfortunately for whales, especially humpback whales, which, as I said, are quite coastal and tend to forage in areas where there's a lot of people. And so ship strikes, unfortunately, do happen and seem to be happening with increasing regularity. I would say two or three a year reported up here in our population, Southeast Alaska. That varies year to year. And then net entanglements. That's another big threat to these whales. In fact, we're part of a network of responders that's led by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And essentially, there's a whole bunch of individuals that are out there that if we hear of a whale entangled in fishing gear, we'll get notified and we'll go out with a whole series of tools to try and disentangle the animal and also collect data on what the nature of the entanglement is so we could start to think about ways to mitigate this or minimize these types of interactions moving forward.
What is their lifespan normally?
Yeah, we used to think it was maybe 40 to 50 years, but we've kind of increased that as we've had in tools that provide more resolution into how long these animals are living. So we now think that a humpback whale may be as old as 90, a really old humpback whale. Interestingly, bowhead whales in the Arctic, we now know that those whales can live to be 200 years old, which is just remarkable. These are very long-lived animals.
That's incredible.
Yeah, for a living species like that. I mean, we know trees can survive for hundreds and hundreds of years. I was not aware that there's an animal like that, a marine species, that can live that long. Is that the longest living marine species that you're aware of?
No, there are sharks, deep water sharks that we know can live to be over 200 years. Wow. And I think there's maybe some of these slow developing, long-lived fish like halibut and things like that. But for a mammal, that is very long. 200 years is exceptional for any species, certainly.
And so how do you track that in their body? Because I know in humans, a lot of the times they do it dentally, right, by their teeth, but they don't have specifically teeth that you can. So how would you track that age?
They had these earplugs, basically waxy earplugs that deposit or accumulate, I should say, layers, much like tree rings. Huh. And so if you had whales that washed up dead on a beach, for example, you could take out that waxy earplug and you could count those rings and estimate that way. Increasingly, we're using molecular techniques where our colleagues have developed molecular clocks that allow us to look at the cells of these animals, the DNA of these animals, and use that to infer how old the animals are.
Just a couple minutes. Are these whales hunted at all by, say, the local natives, indigenous tribes or so, or are they hunted in other parts of the globe?
By and large, humpback whales are not targeted that I'm aware of in any commercial whaling, and I don't think in any indigenous whaling. I could be wrong. Certainly not here in Alaska, mm-hmm. or in Canada, where I'm from, in North America. But there are other species that are. There's subsistence hunts for bowhead whales up in the Arctic that are hunted by indigenous people, certainly in Norway and Iceland and Japan. Other species like minke whales are targeted, but certainly the humpback whales that we study no longer are. They used to be, of course. 100 years ago, there was a lot of whaling here in Southeast Alaska, but there's been a moratorium on whaling for quite some time now.
And obviously that's a good thing. Last minute or so, are you encouraged by what your research is showing with respect to the overall health and welfare of humpbacks and maybe other whale species? In that way, you know, given all the threats that they face, are they adaptable? Or how resilient are they?
You know, I sort of alternate between pessimism and cautious optimism there. The large problems that they are facing really are tied to climate change and warming oceans. And that is a problem that we're going to have to tackle globally. This is not a small scale thing that we, the Alaska Whale Foundation, our colleagues can work on. They do appear to be resilient. These populations have recovered from whaling relatively quickly. And even the impacts of that warm water event that I spoke of, which really impacted things like birth rates and body condition of these whales, they seemed to respond pretty quickly once that heat wave had dissipated a couple of years later, at least.
Right.
And so they are resilient. And the one thing I wanted to point out, too, that we kind of touched on in that paper that we just published, they seem to be very flexible in their behaviors. Humpback whales in particular, as I keep saying, have this very diverse behavioral repertoire. They're tool users. They can use all sorts of different foraging tactics. And I hope that will serve them well as their ecosystem continues to change under these warming conditions.
And if someone was trying to learn more about this, to get that study or to learn more about your foundation, where would they go?
You can go to AlaskaWhaleFoundation.com, or sorry, .org, .org, and I believe that paper is published. It's freely available, published online. It's an open source paper.
Andy Szabo, director of the Alaska Whale Foundation, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you. My pleasure.